I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. Hey, gang, you know our little show here today is sponsored by 750, a service for buyers in New York and New Jersey looking to buy wine, spirits, beer at the wholesale level. But we thought we'd get a few more perspectives in on what's so neat about 750. Today, Aaron Von Rock from Lincoln Restaurant.
Thanks, Levy. I think we've discovered we've used 750.com nearly every day now just to keep tabs on some of our favorite wines. After tasting thousands of wines a year, it's great to know where just in the map all the wines fit. And with all the distributors they're now working with, they're working with nearly all of our favorites. So we find tapping into them every day keeps us in touch with the big picture.
A wine buyer testimonial for 750.com. Thanks, Aaron Von Rock.
Cheers.
Yoshi Takamura is on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Konnichiwa.
Yoshi, you're joining us from Japan, where you were born and where you work now at iwine.jp. But how did you get started with wine?
Sure thing. Well, I thought the interview was going to be conducted in Japanese, but I suppose English would work as well. But thank you for having me. How I got the job is... basically how I got started in the wine business is, right? Yeah. Is basically I didn't grow up in a family of wine. So my dad and my mom used to drink very little amount of beer every night with a meal. And I didn't know anything about wine. And on a special occasion they would drink a blue nun from Germany. And that was pretty much my only exposure to wine when I was growing up. And how I got interested in wine is when I was in college, I was fortunate enough to take a wine course at Cornell.
Oh, at Cornell,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And Cornell is one of those special universities where the underage law doesn't exist. It's exempt from the underage law.
So oh, I didn't
anybody,
know that.
Anybody who is under the age 21 can actually take a wine course and then drink a wine. If you're enrolled in that course.
I imagine there'll be a lot more admissions once this podcast gets out. More applications.
Oh boy.
Going
on. Oh boy. Oh boy. Yeah, so that's how I got started in wine, obviously for the wrong reasons in the beginning because I just wanted to get drunk.
Yeah.
But as I got interested more and more about wine, it just kind of came to me that it would be actually really nice to be able to do this as a job after I graduate. So then I kind of started studying more about wine, and then that's when I got the job at Tribeca Grill after graduating from college.
So you're working with David Gordon.
Yeah, I was. Actually, how I got started at Tribeca was when I was looking for a job at Cornell, Drew Niporn is also an alumni of mine at Cornell. So Drew and David are both alumni of Cornell.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I was looking through the list of the alumni and was looking for a person to call or to email to because I was looking for a job. So I said, listen, I'm from Cornell, da, 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 da. I'm a senior, I'm graduating. Is there any chance you can give me a job? So that's how I got started at Tribeca Grill.
And what was that experience like?
Great. Absolutely great. I wouldn't be here without that experience at Tribeca Grill. Obviously, when you think you know wine, you don't know anything about wine.
Yeah.
So at Tribeca, when I started, obviously, I thought I knew everything about wine because I had studied at Cornell. And, I was confident about my knowledge, but, little did I know. I mean, I met David, and David was like, okay, so if you're interested in wine, you have to study, and you have to go downstairs to the cellar and clean the cellar, and that's how you get started in the wine business. And so I took that seriously. And Tribeca had a amazing wine list when I had joined there already, but it was a list of about 500 wines on the list, and they had a best of awards from the Wine Spectator, and it had an amazing wine list.
What year was that? Well,
that was year 2000.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So kind of there was still boom time.
Absolutely.
Especially for downtown.
Yeah, absolutely. That those were the days when we bought Rémy Bonnemare for $50 a bottle wholesale. So
not much has changed.
No, right? Not much has changed. So then, I started actually even coming in on my days off to go downstairs to the cellar and clean the cellar. Tribeca had a fair amount of stock downstairs that wasn't listed on the wine list. So by cleaning the cellar downstairs, I would say really able to kind of list, you know, the wines that weren't listed on the wine list. And
you actually found stuff. Actually knew where it was. Stuff,
yes, yeah. That were
had know, actually seen yes, the vintage yes. and stuff.
And so basically, we brought the selection of wines up to roughly about 700 or so by just we added
you,
roughly
you found 200 to 250 selections just down there.
Selections downstairs.
How long had Tribeca Grill been open at that time?
Tribeca Grill was open. It opened in 1990.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So 10 years later, it is. You're like, yes. Hey, look, we got some stuff.
Absolutely. And you know, initially, Daniel Jones, I think, started the wine list. And David would kill me for saying this, but and then David took over, and it from the beginning, it had an amazing wine list, amazing wine list. And actually, David showed me a copy of the old Tribeca Grill list at one point, and there was like a Marcassan Chardonnay on the list for like $45 or something. Like that.
Really
ridiculous. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so the wine list grew to about 700 to 750. And that's when I said to David, listen, we need to go for the Grand Award because that would create the hype. And it would really help us become a wine destination restaurant.
Sure.
And because Tribeca, while it had an amazing reputation, it never was a wine destination restaurant. It was one of those great food, great place, you know, Drew's characters, Drew's personality. Everything was fantastic, but it was never known as a wine restaurant. So I convinced David to basically buy a lot more wine and add to the list so that we could apply for the Grand Award.
So you cleaned everything up and then you told him to buy more stuff.
That's
so
correct.
He was probably a pretty happy guy.
That's
you're
correct.
Like, wait, you're telling me everything's clean. We know where it is. I can find it. And you want me to buy more stuff, more toys. Okay.
Yep. So that's when we got the approval from Drew to buy more wines to add to the list so we could go for the Grand Award. And we attended auctions and bought stuff from collectors and basically amassed a list of roughly about 1,200 selections together. And
so you almost doubled it.
Yes,
size.
Absolutely. Because we realized that maybe 1,200 was kind of like the line that we needed to be at.
Kind of seemed like that.
For the Grand
Award.
Seemed
like 1,000 was kind of the line. Yeah.
Right. So we did it. And on the first year, magically, we got the Grand Award. And since then, Tribeca had transformed into an amazing restaurant. Not just a restaurant, but an amazing wine destination restaurant. So I worked at Tribeca Grill on the floor as a sommelier for about 5 years until about 2005.
And it was a lot of Chateauneuf du Pape on the wine list?
Absolutely. That actually came from David. At Tribeca Grill, we had two specialties. One was Chateauneuf du Pape, which we had about 250 selections of. I'm sure by now it's up to about 500 selections. It's probably mostly Chateauneuf. But another specialty that we had at Tribeca was a Rieslings. And that came from me because back then I thought Riesling was like the grape variety that, you know, that's just amazing. So we had a selection of about 70 to 80 Rieslings on the list. And back then, you know, that was unheard of for a restaurant to have 70 to 80 selections of Rieslings.
And they were from like Alsace or Germany?
Mainly Germany because I loved,
wow.
I loved the whole terroir and the vineyard naming system of Germany that was very similar to Burgundy, which I also loved. Sure. So there was a common thread that I saw in Germany that I saw in Burgundy. So that's why. You know,
were there challengers serving German wine back at that time?
I think they're still sitting on some of the stock that I bought back then.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, yes, that is definitely a challenge to sell Rieslings to consumers. A lot of it is because, unfortunately, the ones that are exported out to the U.S. and to the world are that sweet. Mm-hmm. And most consumers don't like sweetness in their wines. So it's certainly a challenge. But, you know, I'm sure those wines after, I don't know, it's been 10 years now, so I'm sure sweetness has dried up a little bit, and they're great to go right now.
Sure. And at what point did Patrick Capriolo kind of join the team?
Patrick started out at Tribeca Grill as a waiter, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, I can't remember, but I'm sure it was like 2000 or 2001. It was shortly after I had joined. And Patrick was interested in wine, but he wasn't serious about wine. But we started talking about the possibility of working together at Tribeca Grill on the floor because, you know, it was a busy restaurant. We did 500, 600 covers a night.
Wow. So it's a big place.
Yeah. And, you know, for me to be the only sommelier on the floor, I was literally on the floor by myself. And
500 covers is a lot, dude.
Insane.
To do by yourself. That's insane.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we were looking for somebody who was passionate about wine, who we could trust. And we found Patrick. So he started doing what I started doing, which was that he, you know, went downstairs to the cellar and started cleaning and arranging all the stuff. And that's how Patrick came about.
I mean, was that interesting to, in a way, kind of organically build a big list? I mean, it was almost kind of like, oh, hey, maybe we do need a sommelier, as opposed to kind of a few years later, I felt like people kind of were like, okay, so we got our five sommeliers ready for the opening. And you know what I mean? They brought big lists from the beginning, but it was kind of like you guys kind of were like, well, I think we could get away with this. I think we could do bigger. I think we could add a guy.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting transition because, you know, all of the waiters were not used to this concept of sommeliers on the floor, obviously. I mean, David has been there since day one, so all the waiters knew that when somebody had questions about wine, they would call David downstairs in the office where he'd be doing office work or desk work, and he would come upstairs and approach a table, and that's how it was before. But you know, all of a sudden we had a dedicated sommelier on the floor, which significantly increased wine service as well as waiters' wine knowledge. So you know, back then waiters really didn't know much about wine, but after getting the Grand Award, we had developed a training system where all the waiters were required to know a certain amount about wine, and it was definitely a positive change for Tribeca Grill. Yeah.
And how did that come about after 5 years where you made the move to Veritas?
Yep. Tribeca was great, absolutely great, where I got exposed to not only French wines, but also wines from other countries, like California, especially Australia, New Zealand, Austria, Germany. I mean, all these regions, all these wines from these regions were, I was fascinated by these wines. But
and they were just kind of coming out of the New York scene.
Yes.
You didn't see a lot of New Zealand prior
not
to
at
that
all. Not
era.
At all. Not at all. So I wanted to specialize in something, and I've always had an affinity for German Rieslings and Burgundies, but I was smart enough to realize that you can't make a living with German Rieslings. I know you can, Paul Greco might be able to, but I knew I couldn't. So I realized that Burgundy is something that I really wanted to concentrate in. So when I was looking for a new place to work at, I realized that the Veritas had one of the most amazing wine lists, in the U.S., if not the world. So I wanted to really concentrate on older wines that are a little bit more special than, say, a $40 bottle of Australian wine on the list. So that's when I approached Tim Kopeck and said, is there any way that I can get a job there? And coincidentally, somebody was leaving there, so I got a job.
Well, it worked out pretty good. And I mean, at that time, though, it was still like, even though they were special wines, they weren't crazy expensive. I mean, I would imagine.
They absolutely weren't. I mentioned Rumier Bonmar, but in 2005, Rumier Bonmar was maybe about $75, $85 wholesale.
Wholesale.
Yeah. So it was slowly but surely, coming up, definitely. But it certainly wasn't the Burgundy scene that you see right now.
Do you feel like you guys helped create that Burgundy scene?
Me? No. I actually just came at the tail end of it. Who really created this is Daniel Janus. And along with him, Tim, who both worked at Montrachet together, they absolutely created this whole Burgundy scene. And, with the La Palais and everything, you can kind of see that happening. So
Do you ever give them a hard time about that? Like, you know, I used to be able to afford Rumier.
Yeah. It's their fault for introducing
that's the guy right there. Right. Get him.
Actually, he, you know. Yeah, Daniel would admit it. It's his fault for, you know, introducing Dovizat and Ravineau and Rumier and, you know, all these guys to these collectors. Because that's when these collectors started catching on with this, you know, with this wine.
And so the way Veritas was set up, you had some partners who invested some of their wine, their cellar, into the wine program at the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so that was Steve Verlin
and Park B. Smith.
And what were they like to work with? What was that experience like?
It was unique, I would say for sure. Park was an amazingly generous guy. He loves wines from the Chateauneuf, which, you know, obviously I had a pretty good background knowledge of from Tribeca Girl. So it was absolutely amazing to be able to chat and drink, to chat about and drink the Chateauneuf du Pape together with Park, because he was just so generous. He would pop open, you know, corks of older wines and magnums, and he would share with us, and it was just an amazing, amazing experience. And Steve had died. He actually just passed away in 2007, roughly around 2 years into my tenure at Veritas. But before he had passed away, he had a passion for Burgundy, which I also had a passion for. So he and I shared, you know, a lot of conversation about how great so-and-so producers are, and, you know, so-and-so vintage is drinking well and so-and-so is not. So we really had an amazing interaction together regarding, you know, wines that we were both interested in.
Seems like he really liked wine.
Yeah,
Steve.
He was truly passionate about it, truly.
Because he came into Danielle once, I remember, took care of him, and he was into it, you know?
Yeah.
And it was nice.
Yeah, and what's amazing about those two are, you know, they loved wine in magnum formats.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, at Tribeca Girl, we had maybe two magnums on the list of the 1,200. But when I came to Veritas, the list was almost like 30% magnums. So that's, you know, I didn't realize magnums could be so great, right? I mean, I was reading books and I guess magnums age twice as slow as regular bottle. But, you know, I never realized that until I actually tasted those magnum bottles versus the 750s.
You could see the difference.
Just how much more fresh and vibrant those magnums are.
And and you get more people drunk.
That's correct. Absolutely.
Somehow the staff has room for a glass too,
and the sommelier can have a full glass instead of just a sip for an ounce.
So it sounds like a better format to me all around. But there had to be some memorable moments at Veritas during the go-go time. I mean, what really stands out for you?
The one that stands out to me the most was when this Mexican billionaire rented out Veritas for lunch, which it wasn't even open for lunch. We were just a dinner-only restaurant. But he had rented out Veritas for lunch for 6 people. And
because the restaurant usually holds more people than that.
That's correct. That is correct. So basically, 6 people, those guys were just in the corner of the room, and they were popping up corks of, you know, 45 Mouton Magnums and 47 Cheval Blanc Magnums, 61 wow. Petrus Magnums, and the entire bill was just something crazy, right? But to be able to taste that kind of range of wines all in just, you know, a couple of hours, that is really, you know, what's special about Veritas. It's that even during dinner service, it, you know, you just never know. Somebody might pop in and you know, open a bottle of Cropéron 2 Magnum 90 from Jair. And that's what made that place just so special.
Yeah. And what did you take working from Tim?
Tim was great. Let's see, where should I start? Tim he had lots of knowledge about Burgundy, which I was happy to acquire from working with him. But not only that, he kind of showed me the importance of not being too dedicated to selling wine on the floor at restaurants. Meaning,
what do you mean by that?
Yeah. Meaning he, you know, he, obviously I thought what's most important was being on the floor and talking to customers and selling wine. I thought that was like the most important job of a sommelier. But he taught me that in addition to that, what's important for the sommeliers is to, from outside of the restaurant, to establish networks and really kind of connect with these collectors. So you basically open yourself up to more opportunities later on. And he was, he's certainly amazing at that, as you can see right now. So he taught me a lot about, not so much about wine, but really so much, really more about how to kind of expand your career outside of the restaurant business.
And Patrick eventually joined you at Veritas?
Yes. I was lonely, and I knew that Patrick also wanted to work with a different wine list. So I said to David, you know, is there any chance that Patrick could come over and work at Veritas? And David was kind enough to let Patrick go and to give us the opportunity to work.
You're saying he didn't like Patrick very much.
He didn't say that. No, but so then Patrick followed me to Veritas, and we started our wine program again together with Tim. So, and those I was there for about 4 years, and that was a special time for me.
You drinking that much 45 Mouton still?
Yes, that helps. Well, no, actually, right now I'm drinking Chilean organic wine that costs $80 a bottle.
So what's that transition been like? You went back to Japan. Yep. Everyone thought you were dead over here. Yeah. I think, you know, no one had heard from you. It's like, I don't know.
It's
like,
funny.
I
yesterday,
you fell in a volcano.
Yeah. And, you know. Yesterday at La Pole, I was, I must have met, you know, I don't know, a ton of people.
A lot of new faces, right?
A lot of new faces, but, you know, some of the old familiar faces were like, oh my God, where have you been?
Well, you also changed your haircut a lot, so it's like...
Oh, did
I? Like, you're like, oh, I don't even who realize. Is that guy?
I don't even realize.
But, so you went back to Japan, and what happened then?
The reason why I wanted to go back to Japan was because I was missing my family.
Okay.
And, you know, I loved wine, I loved the restaurant business, but it was getting to me a little bit because of, you know, nights and weekends and holidays, and I was losing a lot of my friends because I couldn't be with them.
Yeah.
So
my friends prefer that about me.
Oh, is that right? Yeah,
that's the deal.
they try to keep you away.
Yeah, yeah. If you don't actually hang out with me too much, you can call me a friend. That's the contract that I often have signed. You
know. That's funny. So that's when I decided that I wanted to go back to Japan. And, you know, part of one of the reasons for going back to Japan was to find a job that didn't require me to be on the floor every night.
Sure.
So that pretty much ruled out the restaurant business because there's no wine-centric restaurant that's only open for lunch.
Yeah, right? Maybe we should do that. Who wants to get blasted at lunch? Mexican billionaires.
Especially in Japan, where there's absolutely no culture of drinking wine for lunch. So I knew that restaurant was not the way to go. And so I started reaching out to wine distributors where I could, you know, have a little bit more of a serene, calm. So that's when I met Michael Koo, who is the president of Wine in Style right now. We are an importer of fine California wines into Japan. So we specialize in California wines. 90% of our portfolio is about California, and roughly 10 is from the rest of the world.
Okay.
And as part of that business, we have a retail online business, which is iwine.jp that I'm responsible for. So we sell not only wine online, but also, you know, through seminars and classes that I do. We develop a list of private clients, and we sell directly to these guys. Obviously, the wines that we import ourselves, we have a better margin on because we have control over the prices, but we also buy wines from other importers as well. So, and on those wines, we have to pay the full wholesale price. So, you know, I mean, I do all of the selections for the site, and it's been nothing but an amazing transition for me to go back to Japan.
What's the wine scene like there today? I mean, what's
it's up and coming. Uh-huh. People are realizing that wine is an amazing beverage, and it's got a lot of it's good for your health too, because you know sake, as popular as it is in Japan, it's got lots of sugar.
Is that true?
Absolutely.
I didn't know that.
Absolutely. How do I know that?
No, I said I didn't know. Oh, that. Yeah. Yeah. Where's your lab analysis? Right. If you're going to state claims on the podcast, you better have some facts to back it up. I want charts.
Right. So, you know, sake and beer are not necessarily the best thing to for your health. So, you know, in terms of health, you know, Japanese tend to be very health conscious there. So,
no doubt.
They started realizing the benefits of drinking, you know, red wine and you know, tannins and polyphenol and everything. So the wine scene is definitely up and coming, but it's still not part of everyday life.
So, does it tend to fit in more towards like French and Italian restaurants in Japan, or do people have it with Japanese food as well? Or?
Very French-centric, and wine is still something of a special occasion beverage in Japan.
I see.
So you would not see a regular household in Japan drinking a bottle of wine with their dinner every night. That's not happening. And that's one of the challenges that I face. It's that, and I'm trying to convince these guys to really drink wine with, you know, I don't know, udon, ramen. I mean, ramen is a different story, but I'm trying to convince Japanese consumers to really, you know, have an open mind in terms of pairing Japanese food with wine.
And I hear a lot about natural wine being popular in Japan. Is that true?
It's popular, but personally, I don't like them.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. But there is a market segment
there
for
it. There's definitely a market for it.
What is the market like? I mean, when I go to grocery stores, I see a lot of like Petit Chateau Bordeaux that I've never heard of. When I go to the nice stores, I see a lot of expensive Burgundy.
Right.
I mean, what's the reality on the ground?
Right. Market is very French-centric. So I would say maybe about 65% of all the wines sold in Japan are probably from France.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to drink by what the label says.
I see.
Yeah, so that's what I mean by the level of knowledge not being where it needs to be. It's mm-hmm. that, you know, if it says France and Bordeaux on the label, they think, oh, it must be good. So that's really kind of what's going on there right now. So it's a challenge to get these guys to drink something, you know, a wine that they like instead of a wine that they've heard is good.
Is there any tolerance issues, like in terms of
alcohol?
Japanese drinking alcohol?
Absolutely. They tend to get red. And from what I read, Japanese don't have the enzyme that for example, Americans do, to break down alcohol in their stomach. And so that's the reason why they get really pitch red. But, you know, I apparently don't have that problem, so I must have that enzyme in my stomach, which is great. You know?
It's in the water here. But, I mean, whiskey's really popular there. So how does that work? I mean,
It doesn't. I mean, wine is a special beverage when, you know, that's consumed when they go out to a nice restaurant. Whiskey is something that's consumed, you know, after dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, I mean, it's popular, but people drink it because it's alcohol. It's, they don't drink it because they think a certain whiskey is fantastic.
Is that true?
Yeah.
And do you kind of think that in a way you almost kind of return to that proto sommelier era of New York over there? It's kind of like, oh, okay, that was kind of early in on the sommelier scene and the big wine list scene, and there it's kind of just starting to occur as well, or?
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's way behind, though. I mean,
is that true?
Way behind. Like, for example, you know, when I started in New York, it was 2000. The level of sophistication of wine then is nowhere near what it is right now in Japan. So
do you remind people of that often? You're like, let me explain to you who I am.
I try, but it's hard because it's such a traditional culture that things change extremely slowly.
Is that true?
Yeah.
They're not looking for change.
So for some, you know, half American dude like me to come over there and say, okay, let's start drinking Chablis with your sashimi.
Right.
You know, they don't want to listen to me.
They don't want to listen.
They don't want to listen to me. They do listen to celebrities. So, you know, they should really hire somebody like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio to come over there and say, okay, drinking wine with sashimi is a fantastic thing to do. And then it'll become a trend, and it'll become part of a lifestyle.
Yeah, I see. Like, what's that guy from Men in Black? The older guy. What was his name?
Tommy Lee Jones. Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones. Yeah,
I see him on ads all the time over there for coffee and stuff. Yeah, like, what's he doing? He doesn't drink any wine.
Apparently, he drinks coffee.
Yeah. Boss.
Right.
But I mean, are there publications or people searching things out? I mean, one thing I've noticed about Japanese in general is they tend to be very studious when they're interested in a subject.
Yeah, that's 100% true. In terms of wine magazine, they have an amazing array of different types of wine magazines with great pictures. So, for somebody who wants to learn about wine, it is an amazing opportunity for them to have that in front of them because, you know, when I started, all I had was Clive Coates' Côte d'Or.
Sure.
And
how many times did you read that?
Exactly, right? Good at best.
You know, you're like, page 323, it's paragraph 6.
Yeah, I love that. That Patrick and I always used to joke about wines and how, you know, some wines are just good at best, because that's one of the lines that Clive Coates.
Oh, he's right.
Or like worst at best or something like that.
Right. Well, I love when they say like first division, second division. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I don't have any idea what you mean.
Exactly.
Like, first division is not as good as like Imperial Guard I don't know. They have their own classification. It's just like some rugby side thing. I don't know.
Yeah. But, you know, going back to the publication conversation, Japanese have so much in front of them if they really wanted to study about wine. So, you know, availability of information is certainly not what's concerned here. What's concerned is that wine is a luxurious beverage in Japan. So sommeliers often don't get to taste a lot of wines on the floor and in their restaurants.
Is that true?
Absolutely true.
I opened up a bottle of Valentini Trebbiano, a Pierre Gagnard, and there was like four sommeliers like tasting,
huddling around the wine station.
Like I thought it was maybe a big deal. Like I mean, dudes that came in off the street, I think they called people like, "Get here! What are you doing?
Absolutely,
are you up?" Yeah, like, you know, it was a lot of guys suddenly over there. Because I went to the bathroom around the corner and they were all over there.
Right.
I felt like being, "Hey, Patrick! Oh, you know what I mean? You know what I mean?"
That's funny.
You know, so
that's funny.
It appeared all these guys in the braggart jackets. You're the sommelier guy.
Yeah, I know. That's funny. Yeah, that's how it works. And I mean, there are lots of fine dining restaurants in Tokyo that have fantastic wine lists. And there, sure, some expensive wines get opened once in a while. But you know, with the economy and everything, really, a typical Japanese sommelier's exposure to fine wine is significantly limited. What Patrick and I experienced at Veritas is, you know, it just doesn't exist. That drinking culture does not exist.
What is the average sale over there? I mean, at a restaurant or at retail, either one.
It varies, but you know, most people are comfortable spending anywhere between $15 to $20 on a bottle of wine, retail. That is
okay.
Yeah, and what's hard to sell are wines in between $50 to $100 a bottle. And
okay,
that's kind of like the range where it's really difficult to sell there. Anything over, you know, $100, there's always a market for those expensive ones.
Sure.
And that's not difficult. But really, Japanese tend to go for quantity rather than quality at this point. So, for example, online, I have a set of 12 bottles for $99, and that flies like hotcakes.
It's roomy.
Yeah, oh, sure. Yes, I'm a ruse.
So what's the internet culture like in terms of wine in Japan?
It's difficult for me, Levy. It's extremely difficult because, you know, when I was on the floor, I would be able to really look at the customer in the eye and say, you know, this wine is fantastic.
You need to trust me.
You absolutely need to trust me, and you should drink this. But on the internet, I'd have to to translate that passion
by
writing and Facebook.
Yeah.
And tweeting about
you're
it.
Like,
yeah, it's great.
Thumbs
yeah.
up, bro.
So it's definitely a difficult transition for me. And writing is not my forte, to be honest with you. I mean, I can write, but it's not my forte. I'd rather speak than write. So it's definitely a challenge for me that I'm encountering. But, you know, I'm doing it. And, you know, and I have to write in English and in Japanese. So for a guy who's lived 20 years in America, writing Japanese is, you know, oh boy.
Is that what they kind of look to you for, is the English part of it too?
Like, absolutely. We actually, iWine is a special site because we not only have a Japanese entrance to the site, but also English entrance to the site. So all of the wines descriptions are in English, and prices are listed in English, and it's Japanese yen, but and everything is basically English. So I'm in charge of both the Japanese side and the English side. So, and I do all the customer support for both of them. So it's definitely a challenge for me.
Yeah. You find there's a fairly broad English-speaking base of customers in Japan?
That's for sure, especially before the earthquake. We had lots of expats and people from all over the world, you know, coming to Tokyo. And like I said, you know, with those guys, their level of knowledge of wine was significantly high. So they would come to our site and, you know, buy us as a six-pack of Dovizat online, and that was amazing. But after the earthquake, that has changed a little bit. All the expats left, and now it's, you know, it's slowly coming back, but it's still not at the point where it needs to be. So, you know, we'll see.
Whereas people may have been like, I'm going to go to Tokyo. Now they're kind of like, well, maybe not.
Yeah, exactly.
If they don't have to.
Yeah, exactly.
But so you sell across the country?
We sell all around the country. Yep. We ship, but we don't sell out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, Japanese law is very strict about that kind of stuff. So
is that true?
Yeah, we can only sell within the country. But we ship all over Japan.
What's the difference between, like, Hokkaido, Kyoto, Tokyo markets? I mean, how do those things differ?
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak from my perspective, because I don't know about Hokkaido. But I can say that, you know, if you go to Roppongi in the heart of Tokyo, you'll see, you know, lots of wine shops that have, you know, Chateau Latour, Chateau Margaux. But I'm sure that's not the same if you go to, you know, Hokkaido or Shikoku, which are islands in Tokyo. And I'm sure you'll see some bodegas selling, you know, sake and shochu, but you're not going to see First Growth Bordeaux or Grand Cru Burgundy sold at those places. So we actually have a fair amount of customers buying from those islands, and because, you know, they don't have access to fine wine that we have on iWine.
So they want to do it over the internet.
Yeah.
Because there's not the retailer presence that could kind of help them through.
Yep.
Interesting. And if you were, you know, pairing up different wines with Japanese food, with actual Japanese food, I mean, what would be suggestions? You mentioned Dovizat and sashimi. Does Riesling have an application, maybe?
Riesling does, but Riesling, because of its strong minerality, it's not always great with all of the raw fish that comes on a sushi plate. So, you know, Riesling is something that I don't really recommend with sushi all the time. I mean, I recommend Chablis. Chablis is just great.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And
do you find the Japanese like it a little drier?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's been my experience, too.
But it's strange, though, because sake, like I said, sake has a lot of sweetness in them, but they tend to like sake. And generally speaking, Japanese cuisine has a lot of sweetness in them.
Is that true?
All across the board. Absolutely.
I never thought about that.
Yeah. So I think the number of, like, diabetes is significantly high in Japan.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's a concern for Japanese health, definitely. But, you know, Riesling's is... Chablis is great with sashimi and sushi. For red wine, anything that is soy sauce-based,
mm-hmm.
I think is great with red wine. Like fish that is braised in miso or soy sauce, great with Pinot Noir. So there's a dish called sukiyaki, which
that's where you cook with wine, right? Cook it with wine.
You cook it with soy sauce, basically.
Oh, soy sauce.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
It's kind of a hot pot where you cook with it's a beef hot pot.
Yeah.
Where you cook with soy sauce. That's fantastic with like Cabernet. There's, you know, wine pairing is infinite. Options are infinite with Japanese food and wine.
Do you find that that's still, I mean, as you say, kind of being explored a little bit, kind of not really fully developed?
Not developed at all. Yeah. So I think of it as my job to really, you know, whoever I see and whoever I talk to at seminars and classes, I always say that it's absolutely important to open your mind up to and start pairing wine with Japanese food because they tend to go really well together. So.
Do you find any differences with serving? I see that like Japanese people often will drink like one beer between four guys and then order a different beer for the four guys. You know what I mean? Like they'll share more and they'll take smaller pours. Is there any differences with wine that way?
No, they share.
They share.
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing. Yeah.
So, but it's a bigger bottle. So it's
bigger bottle.
It's more like what we would do.
Yeah. But, you know, what's amazing is if four business people may sit down for dinner and they would just consume one bottle of wine. That's unheard of in America, right?
Right.
So,
but don't they, I mean, is it like, is everyone kind of required to have some?
Like, yes, well, kind of they're required to have some in the glass. They're not required to obviously drink the wine.
Right, they're required
to have some in the glass just kind of as a courtesy.
I frequently go to the wrong guy, like to pour. or frequently I'll start with the woman and I'll get in trouble. Like
that's people, correct.
Like hands will come up and they'll
that's correct.
They'll be like, whoa, that's what are correct. You doing?
That's
you, who are you pouring for? So I never know how am I supposed to judge
that's correct.
Who's the guy that I... Because sometimes the guy who orders isn't the guy that you're supposed to pour for.
It's usually the guy who orders is not the guy who
you pour. Yeah, a little tricky. Yeah. A little tricky that way. You know what I mean?
Yes. I'll tell you what. The trick is to serve to the oldest guy at the table.
Is that that's the rule?
Yes. Oldest guy. So the oldest guy drinks first. And then young guy drinks. And then the old lady drinks. And then the young lady drinks.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
So that's kind of like the order.
I think I'm going to start asking for ID. All right. All you guys pass your IDs down here.
Let's see how old you are. Yeah.
All right. I got a 54 here. All right. You're first. It's a little tricky. I mean, there's not a lot of cultures that it radically changes.
Oh, it's so tricky.
You know what I mean?
It's so tricky.
Like from the Western style.
Absolutely.
But that one is like a whole other world. Yeah. And you can really get in trouble doing what you're supposed to do here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, ladies first, the concept of ladies first still does not exist in Japan. You know, men always come first. And I know a lot of female who might be listening to this, may not like what I'm saying, but... That's just the truth.
That's the experience you see.
That's the truth. It's slowly changing, but it's not changing fast enough. So lots of women don't get the opportunity that men do, and it's unfortunate. It's absolutely unfortunate.
What's the regulatory environment like? I mean, in terms of taxes and things, is it flexible or is it harsh? Or?
Tax as in?
All for wine.
All for wine? Everything is a 5% tax in terms of importing or?
Yeah, I mean, in some countries it seems like even in Asia, parts of China, there's high taxes, but Japan's fairly...
It's moderate. Yeah. It's tax is not an issue. I mean, we can bring in anything we want, and tax is never an issue. So
you can. Yeah, so there's really no...
I mean, there is tax, but it's nothing that we should be concerned about. I mean, it's something that we built into the cost of the wine, and that's it.
So. No, I mean, like, there's no geographical boundaries, really.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all.
If you want to bring in Georgian wine...
Not at all. I mean, here in the States... Yeah, here in the States, you have the each state basically making the law, right?
Right.
Yeah, but in Japan, it's really countrywide law. So there's no... You know, it's not like if Tokyo has one law, then Kanagawa has another law. It's not like that.
Wow, so that must make it easier for a venture like yours.
It's so easy.
Where you can go countrywide like that.
If something is fine in Tokyo, then it's likely fine in anywhere you go in Tokyo, in Japan.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what do you see as the future? I mean, in 10 years, what is going to be happening there?
I think with me personally, I like the restaurant business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like that customer interaction. I love talking to people about wine. I love tasting wine and I like drinking wine. So eventually, I may go back to the restaurant business, but not sure at this point. You know, I still have a lot to do with what I'm doing. So I'm gonna continue that for a while. But who knows? Eventually, I might have my own place in Tokyo. But We shall see.
You've been around a lot of bottles. Any particular drinking moments really stand out for you? Special experience?
There are lots of moments, but you know, if I had to come up with one, it would be that when I was in the States, Patrick, Dano, and Tim, and I, the five of us, would go out to lunch together, and once a year, it happens during the holidays, and we would each BYOB a bottle and have a big power lunch together.
I think I witnessed one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, those
were
pretty good.
Oh, you may have.
Yeah.
Actually, you may have.
Donjri from the 20s.
There you go.
Yeah, I remember that quite well. Yeah.
So that to me is, I mean, those lunches are special to me, absolutely special to me, that I wish I could participate in every year, but, you know, unfortunately, I can't anymore. Not only the level of wine that was open, I mean, those guys have a lot of wine in their cellar that I would love to drink.
Patrick's got a lot of corked wine.
Yes, and Patrick always brings a corked bottle of wine. That happened for about 4 straight years. I don't know if he's still carrying on that tradition, but you know, that moment, I mean, the quality of wine was fantastic, obviously, but not just that. It's the fact that we've all at one point worked together. And it's for us to be able to come together and really just, you know, talk about wine, not only wine, but also about ourselves and everything that we've shared. So the moment is special and the wines are special. So those are really what stands out to me.
Yoshi Takamura, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, and excuse my English.
It's better than mine. Yoshi Takamura of iwine.jp, thank you again. Hey, gang, you know our little show here today is sponsored by 750, a service for buyers in New York and New Jersey looking to buy wine, spirits, beer at the wholesale level. But we thought we'd get a few more perspectives in on what's so neat about 750. Today, Aaron Von Rock from Lincoln Restaurant.
Thanks, Levy. I think we've discovered we've used 750.com nearly every day now just to keep tabs on some of our favorite wines. After tasting thousands of wines a year, it's great to know where just in the map all the wines fit. And with all the distributors they're now working with, they're working with nearly all of our favorites. So we find tapping into them every day keeps us in touch with the big picture.
A wine buyer testimonial for 750.com. Thanks, Aaron Von Rock.
Cheers.
All Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.